Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2023 Home Education Conference held in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
So today we're going to talk about setting boundaries. Some of you followed me from another class. So I'll have to come back next year so we can keep hanging out. So one of the things I think are very important as we're talking about boundaries, and this slide's going to show up, I think, at least three times. So we're going to kind of use it as the overview and kind of come back to it again. But when we talk about boundaries or rules, as we're also going to refer to them as, I think it's important to use a sports analogy. And I'm not a huge sports analogy person, so I will tell you just as a quick commercial break on the side as a gerontologist that varsity sports in high school is one of the worst things you can do for your body as an older adult. So I am not always a huge proponent of them. And I was a varsity sports player in high school too, so you know, I've got it. But in sports, and I have here kind of a soccer, so that kind of plays worldwide when I present. Everybody plays soccer, even if they call it football. And there are boundaries. Most of us are familiar. Many of our kids may have played soccer, but you can replace basketball or volleyball or any other kind of a field sport, American football. What happens when you go, we're going to do soccer, people know soccer. What happens if you go out of bounds with the ball?
The ball goes to the other team,
right? So a boundary is a border or limit around certain actions. The action in this case is the ball going out of bounds, kicking a ball or being out of bounds with the ball. Clearly communicated ahead of time. Do you start playing soccer and then halfway through they're like, actually, these are the rules of the game? No. I mean, professional baseball, we have any professional baseball fans out there, rules changed this year. But they didn't change mid-season, right? They had a time in between, and so when everybody starts, everybody now knows there are new rules. Consequences. So they're clearly communicated ahead of time. The consequences are clearly understood ahead of time. Everybody knows exactly what happens when you kick the ball out. They know the boundary. This line doesn't move during the game. So the boundary's outlined, the consequences outlined, and it allows others to use their agency. Can you kick the ball out? You totally can. And are you like out of soccer for the rest of your life? Is your whole life over and done? No. There's a consequence in place, but you can use your agency. And developmentally appropriate. And that one, I always use the idea that when you play soccer with U5, it's slightly different than professional soccer, right? The boundary rules and things are developmentally appropriate and go with the age. Now, other than my phrase down here, all of this comes from the church's handbook on family support for those in recovery, where they talk about how to do boundaries. The church actually has an official statement on how boundaries should work in families. And most of us don't know that. So I am not, I do have academic literature I can back all of this up with, but I'm also here presenting what the church has done the exact same thing. It's from, if you go under, if you're on the app, it's under Life Help Addiction Family Support. It's not actually about addiction, but that's where it's housed because it also applies to addiction. So why do you need boundaries or consequences in your home? You came to this session for a reason.
We have teenagers.
You have teenagers? All right. I like that one. Other reason.
Because bedtime is Lord of the Flies.
Okay, bedtime is Lord of the Flies, yes.
I have found that if you have a system in place, the blame doesn't fall on you, so they don't hate you necessarily. Like, it's kind of magical. Like, well, you bucked the system, therefore this happens, but mom's not the guilty one. Like, the bad guy.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, yeah. The mom is the bad guy because they put that boundary in.
So, like, you're the ref. Like, some people feel like the ref where the ref's getting yelled at, even though they're like, yeah, but this is just the rule. Like, you crossed it. I'm calling it, right? Like, and sometimes people get mad at refs. So we have all of these things both ways.
I need to clarify this. So I don't feel like the bad guy. That's why
there we go.
And this is, I don't feel guilty.
Yes, we want, again, the guilt and shame for those who followed me, right? We don't want to have us following into some cycle of shame for having appropriate boundaries in place. But the question is, do we have appropriate boundaries?
So I'd say in the last couple of years, I realized boundaries are something we uphold, not something that other people respect necessarily. Like, we are the ones that, like, hold our boundaries. And so I think that, like, I love just learning more and more about that, because it doesn't necessarily go with the, like, people pleaser in us, if we uh-huh. have any of that. Like, oh, I want to make this okay.
But is it okay?
Help anyone when you're, like...
Yeah, we want to be able to have, you know, where's that balance coming in? And so here are some, I'm going to read you my questions and see if any of these apply to you. I have, are you trying to change somebody's behavior? You know, getting them to bed on time because right now they run around the house or something. Are you trying to help them learn something? I have this maybe specifically in a homeschool context. You might be trying to help them learn something. And so you have a boundary. Did they do something wrong? Like, they're making wrong choices. Are you frustrated or hurt? And so you need a boundary because you're frustrated and struggling. Are they taking advantage of you? Anybody ever feel like your kids are somehow still taking advantage of you? Right? Like, somehow that's still happening. Are you trying to practice self-care and self-compassion by setting some boundaries to take care of yourself? And are they in trouble? We know what that means, right? I have my air quotes around it, but we all know what that means, right? And you might disagree, but the kids know when they're like, Mom, I'm in trouble. And you're like, no, you're not. They're like, yeah, I'm in trouble. You know, like, or you know they're in trouble. So these are the different types, and it kind of changes a little bit. So we're going to kind of cover these subjects and how boundaries and consequences work in context of these different ideas. These are different reasons why we have boundaries or consequences. So we're going to start with, do you want them to change? Okay, this comes out of the family support manual. I added some academic resources at the bottom. But in some circumstances, when change does not occur, which you may have noticed in your home, individuals, or parents in this case, may attempt to persuade, tried that one, negotiate, restrict, control, or shame their loved ones into changing. Anybody been on either side of that one? Yeah, I've been on both sides of that one too. Also, from too many boundaries and consequences is what that is. When we're getting into restricting, controlling, shaming, and all of those things, that's too much. This is from the church's handbook. This is the next sentence afterwards. Although these efforts may seem to work, lasting effects are often not realized, and trying to pressure family members can create a climate of tension, fear, and resentment. These two slides is the bulk of my academic research, and I can tell you, I don't care what the context is. I've done married couples with diabetes and food trying to help somebody not die. It doesn't matter. Trying to control somebody creates resentment. It worsens family relationships short-term and long-term, and generally just leads to hiding behaviors. You think it might work, but it actually really doesn't. There are so many negative consequences of these things that I want to try to help give you some other strategies of how to set consequences and boundaries that are not going into restricting, controlling, and shaming. So if you're trying to change them, here's the trick. You may think you're trying to support them. And I'll use the example of one of my work where we had one person in the family had type 2 diabetes, which needs to have a healthy diet to help manage it from the doctors. One spouse has type 2 diabetes, one does not. The one that does not, doesn't matter if it's male or female, wants to support the loved one, right? However, if the loved one with diabetes doesn't want to eat healthy, it cannot be called support. Support is helping somebody where they want help. It's controlling if they don't want help. Sometimes we call that nagging. But if somebody doesn't want to change, you are not supporting them. In that case, the support you want to have is to be underneath them for when they're ready. Right? We don't want to only serve salads so that they cannot eat unhealthy foods. That's restricting. But we want to have a space where we say, do you want me to make healthier food for the family? Whether it's the husband or the wife, doesn't matter. Do you want me to help make healthier foods? And if they're like, no, I don't care, then it's not our job to make them care. And for those who weren't in it, and it doesn't matter if it's addiction or in this sort of a case, helping a loved one who needs a healthier diet or has anxiety or anything else, the family support manual that I'm quoting from is really good. Take out the word compulsive behavior and stick in the word that you need. And it will help you learn how to deal with the fact that you can't change your loved ones. And you can't change your 8-year-olds. We don't get to change other people. But there are things we can do. So I will get there. I promise I will get there. Because we kind of get into two steps. Because one thing that happens is they're taking advantage of you. That's one reason why we want them to change. That's actually one of the reasons we get in there, is are they taking advantage of you? We get two things that often come out of that. One is enabling. The only time enabling is a good thing is when it's the atonement, the enabling power of the atonement. Otherwise, that's not for us. In fact, in the family support manual, it states that if you are trying to save your loved one, you are usurping the role of the savior in your attempts to support. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about addiction or if we're talking about them not coming home on time and they're a teenager. We want to be in a different role. However, because enabling refers to them continuing in constructive behavior. That's the other risk, right? You want to control because you're afraid that they're just going to do this thing forever. If it's the diabetes patient, they're going to die from not having a healthy diet, and you don't want to lose your loved one. If it's a teenager, you're worried about the things that are happening. If it's a kid, you know they need their sleep, right? Like, there's things you don't want to have them continue, because the risk is that we'll enable them. We'll allow them to continue in destructive behavior. And we see this a lot in young adults when we do too much for our kids. They get to college. I'm a college professor. I have plenty of college students who can't do things that I would think a college student should be able to do. And it doesn't matter if they came from a homeschool or a, you know, secondary education program at that point. You know, it's what somehow they didn't learn some skills that I had hoped they would. And they're allowed to continue in that behavior. In fact, I have students every semester who want their mom to come in and talk to me about what's going on in the classroom. Or I am an advisor and they won't set their college schedule until they talk to their mom. They can't decide that without their mom. And sometimes I joke that we can call my mom and she can talk to your mom and they can resolve the things. But legally, I cannot talk to the mom. That is against the law when they're over 18. The children now have to decide what college courses they want to take.
Just to clarify, are you saying that happens when you're not strict at all?
Yes, that's what happens when, this is what happens, it can go both ways. But often it happens when you're not strict at all, when you have little or no consequences or boundaries. Because you just let your kids keep doing stuff. They don't have to make their beds, you'll just come make it. They don't have to do the laundry because they don't fold it right, you'll just do it. You know, and then that goes on to other things outside of the house, right? Like, those are little examples inside. And what happens is learned helplessness. And that's what I was talking about with the college. They can't do it without mom or dad. They have to have mom or dad to make it work.
So it sounds like it's not that you just don't, like, let them continue doing it, but you pick up the pieces.
Yeah, so enabling is they continue it, and learned helplessness is you pick up the pieces. So this is the college student living at home, not going to college anymore. They dropped out of college, they're not working, and they're watching YouTube. Because they're depressed. Because life stunk. And it didn't work out. But then the parents realize things didn't quite work out right, and they let them come home. But then where? You know, what are they learning? And it doesn't mean they shouldn't come home. Again, we're going to talk about boundaries and consequences. Boundaries don't mean out or in. right? We don't want to be on the one side when it's so strict and so that it's like a closed circle and you can't get in or out, but we also don't want it too much on the other side where we're doing too much for them and allowing people to continue. Because while we can't change people, we also don't have to allow destructive behaviors to be imposed on us. Right? So it's that boundary. One example is my son, when he was younger, did not want to go to church. And he's like three. And so I couldn't make any of those silly threats like, well, if you don't get ready, I'm just going to leave you at home. He would have been like, cool. Right? Like, I can't leave him at home. I can't make those open threats that don't make sense. Instead, I told him, I said, I have made a commitment when I was baptized to attend church. You are too young to be left at home by yourself. It's against the law. So you're going to need to come to church with me because I'm not going to let you prevent me from keeping my commitments. But you can wear whatever you want. He came in PJs, he came in, you know, I gave him then a space where he could make choices and have agency. Now, I always did pack other clothes in a bag because sometimes he got to church and saw all of his other friends and realized that maybe he didn't want to be in his PJs anymore. But it's about finding boundaries that allow them a space to make a choice. If I just say, you have to come, you have no choice, then he has no choice, and I did not fulfill one of the requirements of a boundary. So then I have to work my boundary to make sure there's somewhere in there that he does get a choice. You can wear what you want. You can either wear this church outfit or you can wear... I carried him in a pillowcase once. He decided he would go to church if I carried him into the church in a pillowcase.
Did you get a picture?
I did not.
She was carrying it.
I was carrying him in the pillowcase and I sat him on. One Sunday, he was totally cool, but he was going to sit up on the stand with the bishop. 4 years old, sat the entire time up on the stand with the bishop.
I need to meet your kid.
But he just sat up there. But he was probably the most well-behaved child in all the sacrament meeting with all those people staring at him, right? Like, he was just like... And I told him he could come down at any point, and he's like, nope, I'm sitting up here today. And I was like... But the thing is, if I try... He is now 17, a very well-behaved priest who does what he's supposed to be doing up on the stand, right? Like, he's now up where he's supposed to be sitting, you know, helping to prepare the sacrament. He did not learn that church was a bad place. He was having a control over church. But now as a teen, he never had that feeling that I made him come. He always had a space of agency. Even when I couldn't give him a space to stay at home because he wasn't old enough, I was in Denmark and I've been around. I'm not home every weekend. He doesn't have to go to church anymore. He has a car, he drives. He's actually not missed once of all the weekends I'm gone. Because he chooses to go. And that's something, because I learned this, when I do my little check marks, does he have agency in this boundary? And if the answer is no, I need to start getting more creative. So what do we do instead, right? We've got these things we don't want to be doing, which I was doing a lot of in the beginning. I always say I cheated that I had my children while getting my PhD, because every class I attended, I like was also at home doing it at the exact same time. And so what do we do instead? We want to set boundaries. Again, I told you I was going to show you this again so that it comes up as we're moving along, that are clearly communicated. The consequences clearly communicated. Allows others to have agency and developmentally appropriate. I would not have told my 16-year-old that I will carry him to church in a pillowcase, right? Like, there is developmental appropriateness that has to come in here, whereas the 3-year-old doesn't understand the social norms. But my 17-year-old loves fashion now and designed a whole church outfit around this suede hat he found. And it's very killer looking. And did I tell him he couldn't wear a hat in the building? No, it doesn't actually state that anywhere. That was up to him to decide. He did not wear it while passing the sacrament, but then he wore it the rest of the time. That was his choice, right? There's no rule there. There's enough things in... That's not what I need to be worrying about. right? So he still feels like he has his agency in how he does things. And that's appropriate for a 17-year-old. I mean, if that's where he's going to rebel, is wearing a hat to church? Like, I'll be pretty happy, right? Like, if this is where we stop. So, what about when you're trying to help them learn? Because that's often where a lot of this comes in. This is usually where we want to be. At least this is our ideal in our head. Or they did something wrong. Again, that kind of follows in together. There's some behavior they're doing that's kind of wrong, and we want to help them to realign or refix or redo something. So I want to talk about the difference between telling and teaching here. I've told you 100 times you should know better. Anybody been there? On either side of that? When you were younger or as the parents? We often don't say, I've taught you 100 times. It is told, and we probably did tell. And I'm going to use an example to talk about the difference between teaching and telling. Running into the road after a ball. This is probably a pretty common thing around the world. Balls run into the road and kids want to follow them. We cannot have kids following them. Why? Cars, right? This is not one of those experiences where you just experience the natural consequence of the world and you figure it out, right? Like, this is not one of those times. So how do we teach road safety? Or do we tell road safety? What's the difference? How can you teach and tell?
Well, we live on a busy street, and so we observe the traffic that is passing back and forth. So you could actually be there observing and have a conversation about how fast these cars are moving, and do you see the crosswalk and the person there? And when that's white, that means you can walk, and that makes the traffic stop. So kind of...
Yeah. I think, good point. Yeah, go ahead.
If you have a kid who needs even more, this is kind of gross, but we've seen, like, roadkill or something, we're like, so... If you need a visual.
Well, actually, that's not bad. No, it's not bad. And not to tell them that's going to happen to them, right? We don't want to, like, have irrational fears. But to say that poor animal didn't know how to cross the street. And so we need to help you know how to cross the street. Because that poor animal didn't know.
Probably a possum.
Probably a possum. So first I'm going to give you an example of telling and then an example of teaching. So telling, this is what you'll find on most websites about road safety. Stop, one step back from the curb or shoulder of the road. If there is no crosswalk, if you have a crosswalk. Look in all directions for approaching traffic. Listen in all directions. And then think about whether or not it's safe to cross. These are all active verbs, but this is all telling. A lot of our... A lot of curriculums are in a telling format too, and often you guys are working for more teaching from telling. So this is a telling format. Whereas a teaching format, if we were doing a teaching development, it does look a little more complicated, and that's why. So before they ever need to chase a ball, young enough before we're playing with balls out on the road, and if we have a chance when there's no cars, I've lived in both situations. Sometimes we have to pick the right time of the day when there's at least less cars. We roll the ball together and sees where it goes. It's a physics lesson. Do you know all roads are shaped for water to run off of them? All roads lead somewhere. And so you roll balls down, and you can teach them that they always will land in the same spot. And so they now know where that spot is. And then when a car's coming, and I do this, and I've moved in different times, we roll the ball, win a car, and if you don't live on a busy street, you can be the car, like your spouse, friend, neighbor, somebody else can be the car, so that they can see that the car doesn't change the outcome. The car goes, the ball goes, car comes, it still lands in that exact same spot that we had just thought it was going to. Now, for you, that makes sense, but that's the difference between telling and teaching, so that they actually experience that it goes in the exact same spot as it did before. Now we know where the ball will be. That's step one. Step two, again, this is where you were coming in. You did a great job. Go to the street together. You may need to hold their hands. And I use a timer. This is math class. So we did physics, now we have math class. So how long does it take from when they can see or hear a car until it's in front of them? Time it multiple times. And it doesn't matter. I've done this with three-year-olds all the way up. They can still read a number, right? That's 3. That's 3.2. That's 3.2. You know, whatever that is. Then when you have no cars, cross the street and time it. You can mathematically calculate whether or not they can get across the street from when they can see a car. And then they know, they now have learned why this is what's happening. I've also added in, so we use a timer, we repeat it. So then they also are learning distance and time. This will also help when they start driving someday to learn how long it takes to get across roads and do stuff. And so there's also future things. In this same thing, I also often have a time, I own a minivan, fairly common. I sat them on my lap and we had a same size friend who came over with the parent. So one of you with your kid is walking in front of the minivan, not while driving, but walking in front. The other one is sitting in the seat so they can see, they can only see the adult. You've told them they can't see you, but they can see the person, so they don't actually know. They've only been told, they've not been taught. So when they sit in that seat and look, they can say, I can't see my friend. And you said, you're right, the drivers can't see you. That's why I need you to have an adult. It's not because maybe even the timing works right, but they can't see you. And again, we have experience that we're just telling them. We've been in the car. We've seen that we can't see those kids. And we're telling them that experience. So the first step in setting a boundary is making sure we've taught the material that we're setting the boundary around. And that's a personal check we often have to do. Did you teach or did you tell? And to make sure kids aren't getting in trouble for things we only told them. It doesn't mean we don't need to talk about it. I have multiple times, even still with my 17-year-old, walked upstairs and said, I need to apologize. I only told you. I realized I was now sitting in the living room. You were cooking dinner. You asked me a question. I answered the question. You know, just this week my son was cutting apples and asked, is this the apple slicer? It's the little round thing with the little wedges in it. And I said, yes. He's like, it doesn't work. And I was like, it might be old. Go ahead and throw it out. That was actually the pineapple slicer. And he felt bad for throwing it out. I said, no, I clearly didn't teach you the difference. I had clearly just told you. I said, I'm sorry that I only told and I didn't teach. There's never too old to not apologize to your children. And I said, we do now need to learn. You're going to come downstairs and I'm going to teach you the difference now. We're going to learn the difference. You know, you may be 17 and I thought you knew the difference, but clearly I didn't teach you the difference. So in that case, one of my favorite boundaries is that I teach, or favorite consequences is that I teach. If I haven't taught correctly, instead of you getting in trouble, if you kind of cross over a boundary I have, but I didn't clearly communicate in the sense that I didn't teach the material, the consequence is that now you're going to have to go through me teaching you the material because I messed up, not because you messed up. You've done something because I didn't set you up right, and that's on me. And I shouldn't feel shame, and I'm not a bad parent. I just didn't teach it, so now I need to. Sometimes we're hurt and frustrated, and we need boundaries. Sometimes we yell at our kids. Has anybody here either yelled or been yelled at by a parent? Okay, good, okay. Just check in, make sure. It's not like new times and ages, we're not doing that anymore. And often we're yelling at them for them to listen. To listen to us. Yelling is actually a very dangerous choice for a boundary or consequence. I was yelled at plenty in my life, so I'm not saying that this is something that can't happen. The reason is because yelling is actually part of our biological nature for safety. when that kid is in the yard and we realized we didn't teach them the whole, like, time it out, do all that thing that Dr. Majewski was talking about, we need to be able to yell and have them respond. We need to be able to say stop, and when they hear that, they know that their life is in danger. Not that they're going to scrape their knee, but that their life is actually in danger. That is what that is biologically built for. That is what God gave us that ability for, was to save each other's lives. If we do not use it that way, we are turning into the boy who cried wolf. And it doesn't have its use anymore like it used to. And many of us have been on that side, where we don't listen until our parents yell, or until they're this, or until they're that, and I'm just as guilty of it. I'm not here to say that I've arrived at some sort of glorious level, but what I'm working towards. So we want to reserve yelling for safety. So if I don't yell, what do I do? Again, teaching is a good boundary. First, do a personal check as a parent, as I said. Make sure that they're not getting in trouble because you only told and you didn't teach. That you're not yelling when it's really you. They may have done something. They may have totally dumped the entire gallon of milk all over the floor. Like something happened that totally should not be happening. And it does need to be cleaned up. But do we need to yell? Is their life in danger? Do we need that voice to come out? If you only told apologize and teach, and be sure when you're doing the teaching, you're in their world. Many of you know this. The kids' world is on the floor. That's why I have some images of people down on the floor with the kids. Kids have an innate ability to feel guilt. They don't often need our help. The kid who dumped the entire gallon of milk on the floor already feels bad. And if they don't feel bad, then that's when we're seeing non-developmentally appropriate things, and we may need extra help because maybe their brain isn't working the way that we want a brain to work, and they need some help to help get through that. And that's okay too. That happens. But they probably feel bad. When you get a ticket, in those of you not from Pennsylvania, if you were to get a speeding ticket while you're here, do you also get a ticket in your home state? No, you don't. That makes no sense. But often kids get in trouble multiple times for the same event. That we don't want to be giving, you know, whether it's you do something and then dad finds out and he does something and then you, if you yelled, that's a consequence. Yelling is a consequence. Is that the consequence you want for that action, is you're yelling? Or are you going to yell and do a bunch of other things? What is the actual appropriate consequence for it? So we're going to kind of move to the side for a second and talk about what do you do with your stress and frustration? Because the yelling is often just your stress and frustration coming out. You don't actually want to use it as your consequence. So there are two things we're going to talk about. Crying and laughing are your body's biological adaptive ways to deal with stress and frustration, not yelling. That's trained. Kids, little kids, what do they do when they get frustrated? They cry. That comes way faster than yelling. They don't yell when they're born. They cry. We teach them to yell. We were taught to yell. I was taught to yell instead of just cry. In fact, we often start shame crying. You don't need to cry. It's not that bad. Why don't you yell instead, right? That's not what we're saying, but that is what we're saying. We just missed the second half. Research shows that those who cry more yell less, and we can teach it. We do trainings, particularly with men, because boys and girls cry the same. Biologically, it's the same for both. And in men and women, it should be the same. It is socially taught for men to stop crying. And so women, adult women, cry 4 times more than men. And we see that inverse in the yelling, and we see women who are crying less. If you have a hard time letting go and crying, you will find yourself yelling more in those moments. It's the way that it works. And we see that expressing emotion is better than expressing suppressing emotion, shoving it down. So I don't want you, one of the things, I put this up here, I don't want you to, instead of getting mad and yell, shove it down. That's even worse than yelling. So we want to get to crying. That's the goal. My kids have also grown up being cry, 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 cry all you want. Keep crying. Crying is good. You feel guilty, cry, great. If you're at school and somebody does something, you cry, don't worry about it. My son is 17 and can still cry. It's taken a lot of work, and he'll come home and he's like, it's hard. The kids make fun of me when I cry. And I say, it's okay. They just don't know any better. Here's the research. Here's the stuff. Trust me, you'll be a much happier, healthy adult man if you can cry. And yes, of course, as we become ways and spaces, if you want to yell, go and cry first. You know, you may need to cry while cleaning up the milk. That's okay. Learning to let yourself cry. If you need a technique to help you learn how to cry, most of you, including the men, have music or movies they cry to. Right? They know, they're like, I don't want to watch that movie. It's going to make me cry. Or they may want to watch the movie. Watch the movie. That's not cheating. That's a technique we use to train our bodies back into crying. Especially if you're socially having a hard time allowing yourself to cry, pick the crying movie and go and watch it after when your kid is being really frustrated. If your teenager is not coming home, turn on a movie that will make you cry so that you've cried before they got there. These are techniques we use to train people, and you can then go on and apply, and you know what I'm talking about in your own life, right? You can now figure out, because there's sometimes music, a song you can listen to. That's even better because it's nice and short. If they're only a few minutes late and you were tracking them on your phone and you know that they can't be there in time because you can see where they're at, and you know there's no way that you don't want them to be home in time because then they would have to be going really, really fast, you know, like, and you're building up frustration about it. Turn on that song, it's going to make you cry. Let those toxins come out. We need the toxins out. The research also shows that yelling does not actually get rid of the toxins. You think you're letting it out, but it actually doesn't. From a physiological standpoint, let it out. They're still there. So, learn to cry. Also important to note that wailing, there's people who are wailing like when they're going through grief and pain. That's okay, that's not the same as crying. It's still healthy, but that's not necessary. We're not trying to get that far. We're just talking about a normal cry. And then we're going to talk about laughter. But before I talk about laughter, I want to make sure we understand that it's not about making fun of people humor. That's not what I'm talking about, okay? Children laugh 300 to 400 times a day, according to recent work, and adults about 17.5, trying to give us as much as we could. Laughter releases endorphins. So laughter releases those endorphins. That's what heals. So crying gets out the toxins, and then laughter builds in the endorphins. Okay, so you want to cry. And so that's why at funerals, you notice people at funerals cry and laugh interchangeably at different rates, right? Like you're crying about what happened, and then you tell a story and people are laughing. Man. That's actually your body doing what it's supposed to be doing. That's what we want to have happen when the kid spills the milk. Cry, let it out, and then we have great journal talk or conference talks too about laughing, right? Mm-hmm. That's the blend.
Question. I have a child who is on the spectrum and struggles mm-hmm. with emotion.
Correct.
He like fake laughs.
Uh-huh.
Is that helpful? Is that
yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I work with kids on the spectrum too, and with them, you want them to have whatever they've got, right? And part of the kids with, and this will be true, one of the things you can do is help your kids learn this, right? So you might be able to hear him have a genuine laugh when he's watching some YouTube video or whatever he's into. And you might hear it genuinely. And then go and teach him, you laughed. You found this funny. Some of us learn our emotions more naturally, but a lot of times we need to help kids. And with those on the spectrum, we just need to help them longer. To be able to help them say, like, when they are crying as infants and young children, we want to help them identify. Are they crying because they're hungry? Are they crying because they're mad? Are they crying because of, and help feed them the words. For kids on the spectrum, we want to feed them the words. They still actually feel the emotions. They just don't know how to interpret them. They still come in. They just don't know how to look at it and see what it is, which is no different than a 2 or 3 year old. So often we say with kids on the spectrum, for emotions, we need to, you look up the literature on how to help a preschooler identify emotions and still do it when they're 8 and 10 and 12.
Okay, so I think I've cried 11 times since I was 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
But I could probably make the semis, maybe the world finals, and yelling.
Yeah, so it seems to fit.
I genuinely feel emotions. I'm just not a crier. I just don't do it. So am I busted? Am I...
No, well, it's true. I was the same way.
I'm awful nervous reading your slide, my friend.
I am the same way. I did not cry. I remember on my mission, I think I cried once. For spiritual or non-spiritual experiences, I cried once on my mission. So I had to actively do some of the crying training like I'm talking about. When I would get movies there, I would maybe sort of feel emotional. I wouldn't cry, but I could feel that kind of, everybody else is like bawling, and I feel a little emotional. I watched more of those, and tried to relax and release as much. I still don't cry as much as others, but I have gotten much better at relaxing and releasing. It's actually, this isn't on mindfulness, but practicing mindfulness really helped me to be able to watch the movies and allow the crying, and allow, because a lot of it was me not allowing any emotions to come forward. And it took me years to be able to cry, and I still don't cry like other people cry.
I don't either. I'm a lot like him. I am a yeller, which I'm going to work on. But how often are you talking about watching these movies? And because you're right. I mean, it's embarrassing sometimes because I sit there and my mom and my sister are bawling over something and I'm just sitting there. So how often are you talking about doing this, you know, like once a week?
Yeah, and it would depend on you, right? I would probably, because of the audience I'm in, say pray about it.
That's true.
And follow the often you need right now. Okay. Again, don't judge yourself and say I need to be there tomorrow. If you yell 1% less and cry 1% more, you're now going to cry once this year instead of none. Like, that's progress. Okay. Like, don't get mad at ourselves because we're not... Because, again, I was on the non-crying side. I cried as a kid. My mom verifies that I did cry when I was little. But I trained out of it and was scared of crying. And it has taken a lot of work to be able to allow myself to feel those, like, not just feel them, but express it in that way. And so I no longer yell at my kids. I haven't yelled at my kids in a really long time, but it took me years to get there. So it, again, don't judge yourself.
So how do we teach our kids to deal with their frustration and stress? Because my boys will, I'll be like, okay, you're too out of control. You need to go to your room and calm down. Like, I don't teach them to go to their room and cry. Is that healthy? Like,
well, you want to encourage them to cry. Go to your room and cry if you can. And they might be like, that's really weird, Mom.
Like, what?
They will say that. But it will train. It'll train their brain over the years. Their wives will appreciate it. Even if they don't understand it now. We had a comment back here.
So I found that, so I'm not a crier either. But I've noticed that in recent years, I have been able to cry more and had some really good experiences with crying. And it's been discovering audiobooks and good literature I can listen to that's emotional and deep and meaningful. I don't watch TV. Movies, I don't have time for movies. I can't sit down for 2 hours and watch a movie. I can't do it.
No, again, it's
and
not about the right way.
Something else. My mind would have to be occupied with something else. My son may be crying. But I can do the dishes and listen to
an audiobook.
I can. And I will have moments where I'm, you know, touched deeply by the story. I get more touched. And now, of course, movies, because I'm a book person, they're very shallow to me. Movies are more shallow. But anyway, and I'm able to release those emotions through literature and poetry.
Yeah, and so finding a way, again, I would tell you to pray about it and don't be worried about the weird answer you get. If you sincerely ask, how do I pray and laugh more appropriately? How can I increase these in my lives? Whatever weird idea that comes into your head, it will probably work. Whatever that is, and I don't know what that is, but whatever it is. All right, so I want to move real quickly to also talking about the difference between consequences and punishments. Punishments are the things that are controlling and restrictive. Like, these are the ones associated with negative outcomes. Consequences are associated with more positive outcomes. Punishment is when you're inflicting pain on a person guilty of an offense. They did something wrong and you want to punish them. Consequence is that which follows. It can be good or bad, right? Spilled the milk, it's got to get cleaned up. That's not a punishment because it's spilled and it's on the floor and we have to clean it, right? A punishment is the idea of you want them to feel pain too. It can be the exact same thing, but you have a desire for them to feel pain out of it. So they forget to do their chores and lose TV, video games, phone, iPod, gets grounded, etc. That's called punishment. If you lie, people don't trust you. That means you can even be at home, be a little silly about it. Somebody lies and then they say, Mom, I do this. How do I know if you're telling the truth? Right? You help them understand a natural consequence. If you go outside without a coat, you'll get cold. But how do we actually apply that in the real world? Because we can't always do that. If we look at traditional discipline, spanking, these are the research findings, over too quickly and damages relationships. We find the yelling and the lectures are associated with power struggles and a lot of contention. Loss of things, it doesn't usually teach a real world context. When you're out of work in a job and you spend too much time on your phone, they don't take it away or make you sit in timeout. The behaviors in sticker charts, you really are attached to them. They only work short term. They're not a very long term. That's a very nice little, this week we need to work on something thing, but they're not really good long term. So, logical and consistent consequences. Here's the questions I ask myself. Does this consequence mirror real world consequence for the child when they leave home? You know, who's going to monitor their phones if you always monitor their phones? Only one consequence, the event of like my kid got in trouble at school, school called me when he was going to school, and I said, are you going to punish him? And they, do you have a consequence for him? And they said, yes. I said, then I'm doing nothing at home. If you want me to do something at home, don't you do anything at school. You don't get in trouble in both states when you get a speeding ticket. Do you want it to be me or do you want it to be you? I'm good either way. I'm happy to be the happy person who can talk about it, make him feel better because something happened at school. Or if you want me to be the one at home, you just pick, but I'm not doing it twice. Yelling and grounding, right? Like, don't do two consequences for the same thing. Choose wisely. Does this consequence have the same implication for the child as was the adult? This is the one I want to end on if I don't have time for anything else. If they can't eat ice cream before bed, you can't eat ice cream before bed.
Oh, crap.
Because you're the one whose body shouldn't be eating ice cream before bed. Their body can handle it. Sugar does not cause hyperactivity. See my previous class if you weren't there. That is not what it does. If they're not allowed to have phones at the table, you're not allowed to have phones at the table. If they can't talk during church, you can't talk to your spouse during church. Watch your boundaries and make sure they're the right ones. Maybe it isn't that you can't talk during church and you can't have ice cream before bed. Maybe you have the wrong rules. So make sure you're taking a step, taking a chance, and looking at what you've got and running through the rules to rules. Thank you very much for your time.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this record. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.